KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. 50 years after the fall of Saigon, the Vietnam War continues to loom large in how the public and the U.S. military considers armed conflict. It remains an ongoing lesson on the effects of combat on the people exposed to it. Of the 2.5 million Americans deployed to Vietnam, Native Americans served at the highest rate compared to other groups. Today we'll talk with veterans about what we've learned in the 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War. We get started right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Today is Memorial Day, and across the U.S., parades, ceremonies, and similar events are being held to honor those who served and died for their country. That includes an observance from an MMIP activist in Oregon. Kimberly Linning is the founder of MMIW Search and Hope Alliance. She says she's collecting names of fallen Native soldiers, not just in combat, but also those who struggled at home.
Last May, I lost a very close friend of mine. He took his own life, and it was very sad and very tragic. He was like a brother to me, and this year I thought I need to get more involved and bring more awareness to that. And I also would like to bring more awareness to the Indigenous fallen service members and how they became so ingrained into our military.
Linning is hoping to present names of Navajo co-talkers. Being Navajo, Hopi, and Mexican, she says it's a way to honor the men who used their native language to radio in troop movements during World War II.
And I think it's important that more people know about that and those who gave their life in service of that. It's more than just outside non-Native communities. The Native peoples have had such a big role in service to this country and fallen for this country. And I just want to bring it to the surface and start conversations, not just about history, but how to preserve Indigenous languages across the board.
Linning says the completed project will be a video slideshow that she'll make available on her social media channels, including that of her organization, MMIW Search and Hope Alliance. Acclaimed Indigenous chef Sean Sherman is expanding his nonprofit to Montana. YPR's Ruth Eddy has more about his plans in Bozeman.
So we've got ground elk, onions, delicata squash. We just chopped it up real fine. It's got sumac, cedar, and salt in it.
Chef Rob Ganin with the nonprofit Indigenous Food Lab is grilling at the kitchen of Fork and Spoon in Bozeman. The social enterprise restaurant run by the Human Resources Development Council serves pay-what-you-can meals 5 nights a week, but also rents out its commercial kitchen.
There's no stress, obviously. You're not yelling at each other.
Tonight, the kitchen is being used for a pop-up dinner as a taste of what's to come in Bozeman, as Sean Sherman's nonprofit starts using the kitchen regularly sometime in the near future.
Our goal is to try and get food access to tribal communities all across the state, and that's what we're hoping to do right here in this building.
Sherman's restaurant in Minneapolis was named James Beard's Best Restaurant in America in 2022. Awamni highlights Indigenous ingredients by removing colonial ingredients like dairy, wheat, flour, cane sugar, beef, pork, and chicken. Tonight's 7-course pop-up does the same.
Put a lot of artistry into the plating, you know, and just really take a lot of care with the ingredients that we're playing with.
The elk skewer is plated on top of a dark red circle of sauce made from currants, topped with fresh ramps and drizzled with a pine syrup. Sherman explains.
We harvested this pine, cut it all up, and then we're going to cook it down with some maple syrup and some water and just let it simmer for a long time till the water starts to evaporate, but it'll absorb a lot of this pine flavor.
Megan Vincent was one of about 80 guests at the pop-up. She's a culinary arts teacher at a high school in Lewistown. She said the food was amazing and the braised bison and wild rice flan were favorites.
I really want the dessert recipe to see if I can make that with them, because the idea of making a dessert taste that good without using those standard ingredients of sugar and dairy would be a really great experience.
In Bozeman, I'm Ruth Eddy.
And this is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Arctic Encounter Symposium, North America's largest Arctic policy event at the Denaina Convention Center and Anchorage Museum, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska. Registration for this global conversation at arcticencounter.com.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. More than 50 years later, the smell of diesel fuel takes Frank Sewell back to the chaotic and intense combat in Vietnam. At times, he still struggles to fight his way back from those memories. Sewell volunteered to serve in the Army in 1970, assuming the draft was coming. He was one of an estimated 42,000 Native Americans deployed to Vietnam. We'll hear from him this hour. We'll also hear from renowned artist Harvey Pratt. He had a 40-year career in law enforcement, helping solve cases as a forensic artist. Before that, he also served in the early years of the Vietnam War. His story comes full circle. He is the designer of the National Native American Veterans Memorial at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. Today, we'll hear from them and other Native veterans about their personal journeys and what the Vietnam War has taught all of us in the 50 years since the fall of Saigon. Joining us now from Guthrie, Oklahoma, is Harvey Pratt. He's an artist and a Marine veteran. He is Cheyenne and Arapaho. Hello, Harvey. Welcome back to Native America Calling.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Joining us from Rosebud, South Dakota, is Francis Whitebird. He is a Vietnam War Army veteran. He's from the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. Francis, hello to you as well. Welcome back to Native America Calling.
Wow.
Great to have you on the show, Francis. Joining us from Seminole, Oklahoma, we have Frank Sewell. He's a Vietnam War Army veteran. He's Creek and a member of the Seminole Nation of Oklahoma. Frank, hello and welcome to the show.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Rachelle Pablo. She's the museum specialist for the National Native American Veterans Memorial at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. She is Dene. Rachel, hello to you as well. Great to have you on the show.
Rachelle Pablo, it's nice to be present with all these honored veterans.
Thank you, Rachelle.
I'm a veteran. Thank you.
You bet. Appreciate it, Rachelle. Harvey, I want to begin with you. Your service in Vietnam, it was relatively early, starting in 1962. What did you know about the war at that time?
Well, I didn't know anything about what was going on in South Vietnam. I volunteered when they came to my camp there in the Okinawa, and they were looking for volunteers to do something special, and so I volunteered. I mean, that's the way I was raised as a young Indian man. I was raised by people that were born in the 1860s and 1870s, and their attitude was a little different. You know, we weren't allowed to cry when we got hurt. No crying. So they had that kind of attitude and always try to be first and get your nose in there someplace.
Harvey, what was it about the Marines that made you want to join that division of the armed services?
Well, my mother's younger brother was a Marine, served in the Second World War, was missing in action several times and is wounded several times, and so he was always my hero. And we were raised to always go shake the hand of veterans, and so he was my hero. And he actually was still in the Marine Corps whenever I joined in 1962, and I ended up in Vietnam in 1963. And he came to see me while I was in staging battalion, and so I stayed in contact with him, and he was always somebody that I admired, and he's the one, that's the reason I joined the Marine Corps, because of him. And when I told my mother that I had joined the Marine Corps, I always called it the silent scream. She looked at me, her mouth fell open, and she had that look on her face, but I didn't hear anything. So I called it the silent scream. And then I found out later on that a lot of mothers had that silent scream when their children volunteered or joined the military. So she raised us to be warriors and not to be crying and always take care of our sisters and our family. And that's the way we were raised. And so my Uncle Charles was the man for me, and he was still in the Marine Corps when I joined, so he was World War II, Korea, and Vietnam before he retired.
Harvey, you mentioned being raised as a warrior. I want to ask you, just how did your Native community and your culture help you prepare for your involvement in the war, and what do you remember most about your time there?
Well, you know, When I joined, it was because that we were always expected to protect my aunt and my grandpas. You protect the camp or protect your sisters. My sisters were all older than us, and they wanted to know how come the family treated the boys better than they treated the girls. And my aunt Laura Birdwoman told them, those boys are going to have to die for you someday. You know, they're going to have to protect you. They have to give their life up for you. That's why we treat them with respect. So I always kept that in mind growing up. And so when I did join the Marine Corps, I was sent to Okinawa. And that's when the 3rd Reconnaissance Battalion, Lieutenant Hughes, which was our lieutenant for the platoon, and he came through and was asking for volunteers, and just because we were told, you know, that we needed to be first and do those things, I volunteered immediately. I didn't even know where we were going. My initial thoughts were we were going to go to South America, you know, but we ended up in Vietnam, and they didn't tell us all the time we were training that we were going to South Vietnam, until we actually were on the way, and then they told us where we were going. So it was a big surprise to me that we ended up in South Vietnam in the jungle. And as a combat platoon to protect Da Nang Air Base and to pick up downed pilots, and that was our primary function.
So, Harvey, you were doing air rescues. You served in an air base. Tell us a little bit more about that and what kind of training you had that enabled you to fulfill that mission.
Well, actually, when we volunteered, they sent us to a 3-month guerrilla warfare training. And that's what they called it in those days, was guerrilla warfare training. And so we trained in that, and we trained in rappelling from helicopters into an LZ to pick up pilots. And so our function was they called us stretcher bearers. They didn't call us anything. They didn't call us combat troops. They called us stretcher bearers, and had to sign a release that we wouldn't talk about it for 10 years. Because in 63, the Marine Corps was not supposed to have combat troops into South Vietnam. And I didn't know all those things at the time. We had, when we went over there, that was our function, was to pick up the downed pilots, because apparently they were losing a lot of pilots, and they weren't getting the ARVNs to go in there and pick up those downed pilots. And so they had to retrain a group of us, a platoon of us, to go in and pick up the downed pilots, protect set a perimeter up, so that we could send engineers in and mechanics in to either get the helicopter where it was flying again or blow it up. And that was our function. And then we were to protect the airbase of our airplanes and helicopters that were there. And so we did perimeter security around the base. And one day we'd be on that, and one day we'd be on standby to fly out and rescue somebody, and one day we'd be at the airfield. So it was kind of a multifunction, and I really didn't understand what was going on. The only that bothered me the most was when we'd get in a helicopter, we didn't have flak jackets. And I always wondered why they didn't give us flak jackets. And we sat on our helmets, you know, in a helicopter. And that was all we had. And I used to always kind of bother me, because I thought that they should have given us flak jackets and something to protect us while we were in the helicopter. And later on, they did get flak jackets to everybody, but we didn't have flak jackets. And that bothered me a lot, especially walking around the base camp, the perimeters. Always figured we were the first guys to get shot, you know, and I wanted a flak jacket, but never had one.
Harvey, what do you remember about when the war ended and you came home and returned to your community?
Well, I came home in 65, and we were just sending troops over there in 65. And so I always, because they told us we weren't allowed to talk about it, I never said a great deal about what I did, you know. And when I did, a lot of people, not only veterans, but that they didn't know about troops being in there in 63. So I was accused of stolen valor a lot. And that used to really, really upset me, you know, because I knew we were there under a shoe fly operation. And when I tried to get some information about my duty, and all my DD-214 just said I was in Southeast Asia. It didn't say where I was, and I couldn't find any records to justify that or to say that I was in South Vietnam until I contacted my congressman, and then he found all of my...
All right, Harvey Pratt, kicking off the conversation here today on Native America Calling. He's an artist and a Vietnam veteran. We'll be right back.
There is a considerable confusion in the wake of changes to federally funded services over the last 4 months. We'll check in with education institutions, support for low-income Native Americans, and a rundown of what is in store and what's called the Big Beautiful Bill heading through Congress. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Hey, 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 hey
You are listening to Native America Calling. Today we're talking with Native Vietnam War veterans about their reflections in the 50 years since the war ended. I'd like to introduce another guest now. Joining us from Honolulu, Hawaii is Alan Ho. He's a Vietnam War Army veteran and an attorney. He is Native Hawaiian. Alan, good morning and welcome to Native America Calling.
Yeah, you're welcome. Aloha kakahiaka. Good morning in Hawaiian.
Aloha to you as well, Alan. Now, you were drafted and you served in Vietnam from 1967 to 1968. What do you remember about the day you received your draft notice?
You know, for me, growing up here in Hawaii, my culture and all of my experiences were that was something to be expected. You had the choice to join the service, or at some point, Uncle Sam would call you to serve. And I was having too much fun as a young teenager, surfing, et cetera. So I just assumed at some point I would be called by Uncle Sam to come and serve. And in 1966, he did.
Now, you were trained as a medic. What led you down that road?
Well, you know, being drafted, you don't have too many choices. And one of the first things you do when you enter the service, they give you a battery of tests. And it just came about that I was assigned to go to Fort Sam Houston to train to become a combat medic.
That's Fort Sam Houston in Texas, is that right?
Yeah, San Antonio, correct.
Alan, being a medic, you're right there. You see it all. I mean, those losses on the battlefield, how did those impact you during the time you were there in Vietnam? And then how has that those memories, how have those evolved over time? And how do you reflect?
You know, our training was such that it was so repetitive that when that first shot was fired, you just kind of started to react in accordance to your training. There were numerous different types of combat experiences, those who served with a rifle company. I was, in my opinion, fortunate to be assigned to a long-range reconnaissance team. So I traveled in a relatively a small group, and I was trained to respond when one of my men got hit and the call went out for doc. Combat medics historically are referred to as doc, and when you respond to one of your teammates who has gotten injured, you just react according to your training. And you put out all of those other feelings, et cetera, because you know that you must respond quickly and be prepared to address whatever you're confronted with.
Mm-hmm. But at some point in the future, you must sit down and I would imagine you reflect and it all kind of sinks in. What happens then and what's the thought process?
Well, you know, for me, I guess the biggest impact was the fact that I lost so many guys. And over the years, you contemplate and you think about, you reflect upon the tight relationships that you develop with these young peers, your young peers that basically come from all across the great expanse of America. And to this day, from time to time, when some of my men who will call me on the phone, I will pick it up and they will just open with, "Hey, Doc." And immediately I know who I'm talking to. And that is, I think, perhaps one of the most astounding experiences of my combat in Vietnam. I remember the first time in combat when I saw someone with a very serious wound. I didn't think about it then. Later on, I just thought in terms of, wow, what that presented and how I responded to that and how I treated it. And at the end of the day, it was it all came back to repetitive training while you were in combat medic training.
Alan, you earned a Bronze Star. You earned a Purple Heart, as well as a Combat Medic badge. Hearing you describe the relationships with some of those other soldiers there, is that one of your proudest accomplishments, just being able to maintain those relationships throughout the years like you have?
You know, absolutely. Growing up in Hawaii in the 60s, the decade of the 60s, I sort of lived kind of a sheltered life, if you will, although I had lived in Washington State for a number of years with my parents. My dad was a World War II veteran, and he took advantage of the GI Bill. And so I got to meet and appreciate all the different environments of growing up across the United States of America. And for me, it was just an incredible opportunity. One of the most fascinating things is a young boy I met while living in Washington. When I came home to Hawaii, I never thought I'd ever see him again. You know, 6 years later, I jump off the deuce and a half truck at my first assignment, and I hear a familiar voice shouting out, "Hey, Alan O, is that you?" And I went, "Oh my God, that's my good buddy Raleigh Morrison. What the hell are you doing here? This is the same thing you are, you know." And today he's retired as a chiropractic doctor, and he lives in Temescal, Washington. And yeah, that's how small our Army is, in even in terms of how huge and how expansive soldiers are and where they come from.
Alan, thank you so much for joining the show today. Alan Howe, Vietnam War Army veteran and an attorney, speaking with us from Honolulu, Hawaii. Let's now talk with Francis Whitebird. He joins us from Rosebud, South Dakota. He is a Vietnam War Army veteran. And Francis, I understand you were already a college graduate when you enlisted. What prompted you to join the military?
I'm trying to fix my phone here. can you hear me?
Yeah, Francis, you sound great.
Yeah, well, the draft was after me. So I knew I couldn't get a job, so I decided to join the military. But before that, I want to say, hi, Alan. It's nice to hear from you.
Again, this is a classic example.
A brotherhood. I hear brotherhood, for sure.
Yeah, Alan and I were in the same brigade together in the same, about the same time in Vietnam. He was a long-range patrol medic, and I was a rifle company medic. And I was in charge of 40 people in my platoon, and then the casualty rates for medics was so high that I served two months in one company, and then I became the company medic for another company, and then I was in charge of 140 people. And I was a PFC. And it was an E5 position, so they hurriedly promoted me to E4 and then the E5.
Francis, when you went to Vietnam, how familiar were you with just what the war was about and the issues and just the overall reason for the U.S. military being there and engaged in that war? What did you know about that going in?
Well, my community is like Alan's. My dad was a Lakota code talker. And when I was growing up, practically everybody in my community spoke Lakota language, and they served in both theaters, Europe and Asia. And I was expected to go into the military and serve. One of the things that I didn't do when I got my orders for Vietnam was I didn't tell anybody. I figured I could spend the time over there and come back and just say, oh, yeah, I've been to Vietnam. I didn't write to anybody except my older brother. And he was the only one who knew I was in Vietnam. And the whole idea of combat was everybody in my family, they were in combat, so I had to go test myself and see how I was doing. I didn't want to be sitting in a desk job or anything. I wanted to see where all the excitement was.
Mm-hmm. Well, Francis, hearing you describe that that the only person who knew you were in Vietnam was your brother, what was your homecoming like? I mean, you must have just gone home and shown up and like, what did people ask? Where have you been, Francis? What have you been doing for the last couple of years? What did you tell him?
Well, when I came back, I was out of the Army. I spent 18 months in Vietnam, and I didn't want to serve stateside. The tour over there was 12 months. And so when I came back, I went to my brother's place in Michigan. And then I called and told everybody I was back from Vietnam. And he drove me back, and I had this big, huge homecoming. And my family put up a ceremony. And at that time, there was a table for World War One, and a table for World War Two, a table for Korea, a table for Vietnam, Korea, World War Two, Korea, and Vietnam, and of course in Lakota, of culture, my family had gifts for everyone and fed everybody and. They had a song maker made a song for me, and I was too, I don't know, I wasn't paying attention to it, so I lost the song.
Francis, you explained that a tour in Vietnam was 12 months. Did you ever think about going back and doing a second tour?
Well, the next 6 months, it was a continuous tour for 18 months. So the second 6 months was my second tour.
Got it. Okay. So now here it is, Francis, 50 years since the end of the war. How do you reflect now on your experience and the war and just everything that's happened since then? Where does it all fit within your life?
You know, first we had to deal with all kinds of stuff like PTSD, and that took a while. You didn't think of anything. People think, well, you know, we came back and became philosophers and thought about this and that, but many of my people in my company, their bodies are here, but their minds and spirit are still in Vietnam. And my company, we have a annual reunion every year, and we're dying like mad. And when I was with this rifle company, we weren't fighting for America or anything else. We were fighting to keep each other alive so we can come home. And we certainly had enough casualties. I mean, my company, we were involved in a third largest, longest, a battle in Vietnam. It went for 13 days, and it involved the Marines and the 196th Light Infantry Brigade, the first same one as Alan Ho is in. And the Hamburger Hill happened in June, and there was such an outcry for that that when we were in that battle, you know, lucky for the military, Woodstock was going on, so they covered Woodstock and they just ignored Battle of Head Duck. But there were plenty of casualties, and we never really got the coverage that Hamburger Hill did. And it was a hill. It was 102. And when we left that place, there was not a leaf on a tree, and the place looked like it was dug up by a plow. We were attacking bunkers, and it was. And Charlie was tough. We fought the 2nd NVA Division in a valley called Quezon Valley. There are more Americans killed in that valley than Quezon or Battle of Way. So there was just I forgot to mention that there were body parts all over the place. It was pretty gruesome.
Francis Whitebird, Vietnam War Army veteran, a medic from the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, joining us here today on Native America Calling. Francis, listening to you, it's like a history lesson. Hamburger Hill, Saigon, just some of these really, really pivotal, monumental battles and events as part of the Vietnam War. Really appreciate all of your insights, along with our other guests as well. We're going to take a short break, and we're also going to talk to our other guests on the show today as well. We've got Frank Sewell and Rachel Pablo. So, listeners, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Summer Youth Powwow to foster community relations, youth literacy, cultural exchange, and provide local community resources. Trickster Cultural Center's Summer Youth Powwow is open to the public at no charge and takes place May 31st in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at tricksterculturalcenter.org/summer-youth-powwow-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Support by the American Indian College Fund. The American Indian College Fund provides millions of dollars of scholarships to thousands of Native students every year. Tribal citizens of every age and experience are eligible. The deadline for applications is May 31st, and you can find everything you need to apply at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org, or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Education is the answer.
Support by Alaska Growth Capital. The Bristol Bay Marketplace is now open. Bristol Bay Native Corporation shareholders, descendants, and spouses are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace. Support for this program provided by ConocoPhillips Alaska, operating in Alaska for more than 50 years and valuing the opportunity to partner with Alaska Native communities.
You've got to tune to Native America Calling. I am Sean Spruce, and we're talking with Native Vietnam War veterans today about their experiences in battle and what their service means to them now. Let's go to the phones. We have Tom, who is listening in Socorro, New Mexico on KUNM. Hello, Tom. Thank you for calling in today.
Hello. Can you hear me?
You sound great, Tom. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I just want to state that I was drafted in 69 and spent 1970 in Vietnam. I was drafted in the Army, signed up for a Marine Corps because I was a tough farm kid that didn't know any better. And in 69, I guess, my girlfriend was heading to Woodstock, and I was going to boot camp, maybe August, middle of August, 69. Anyway, I just want to state that I served with a lot of Native American in boot camp and in Vietnam in our company. And we were in Quezon Valley and Antenna Valley in the mountains, on the flats. We were all 19, 20. And I was wounded twice. And they kept sending me back because they only, you're in there for 12 months. And if you're only, I signed up for the Marine Corps for 2 years, so they knew they couldn't get me on another tour. But anyway, a Marine was wounded with me. We called him Chief, but his last name was Bullplume. I think he was from Montana. And at the same time, I was once, and I never seen him again. I'd love to know that he's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Let me ask you a quick question, and we're going to take another guest. But you said you served in, you were at the Battle of Quezon. If you ever go down I-40 heading west, right through Laguna Pueblo, about an hour outside Albuquerque, there's the Quezon Bridge. Have you ever noticed that on I-40?
I have, yeah. But the Quezon Mountains was different than Quezon.
Oh, too. I'm sorry. Okay. Thanks for the clarification.
The Quezon Mountains and the Antenna Valley was out there, and I think that's where the fellow mentioned the Valley of Quezon. It must be right there where I was too. It was a lot of Marines, and it was an experience that I just will never forget. I just have a lot of admiration for the Native people that served with me. They were awesome, awesome brothers. We did it for each other.
All right, Tom. Really appreciate you calling in, joining the conversation. That's Tom listening on KUNM in Socorro, New Mexico. Let's now talk with Frank Sewell. He joins us from Seminole, Oklahoma. He is a Vietnam War Army veteran. He's Creek and a member of the Seminole Nation of Oklahoma. Frank, hello again. Great to have you on the show. And let's talk about your story. You enlisted around 1970. What prompted you to join the Army?
Well, actually, I enlisted in 69, but what prompted me to go in the Army when I was a little one, I was playing in the middle of the street, and there was this arm guy came out of his house, and he had his fatigues on, and I saw him, and to myself, I just thought, that's what I want to be, but I never told anybody that, and So I guess that's what interests me into volunteering for the military.
Well, tell us about your training. I understand you were a jump man.
Yeah, I went to, I enlisted, went to Fort Polk, Louisiana, went to South Fork, and I thought I was going elsewhere, but they sent me to North Fork, which they called Jungle Land, or Jungle Tiger Land is what it was. And so I ended up there, and some guy from jump school come down, basic training, looking good on his jump boots and his khaki uniform. And he said, "Is anybody here want to join the go to jump school? Everyone training." And he said, $55 a month extra. And I raised my hand. I said, "I'll go." So I went from there to Fort Benning, Georgia, and then from there, I went to Vietnam in 70.
Mm-hmm. And where were you deployed, Frank, in Vietnam?
I was deployed my travels were from Oklahoma City to Fort Lewis, Washington, process, and then went to through Alaska, Japan, to Cameron Bay, and came back to Samway. But from there, from Cameron Bay, I went to Sharang Valley, the Trang Valley, or something like that. And they told me that I was going to be sent to jungle training. I said, okay. So I went from there, and it was like 2 weeks, I believe it was. And I went from there, got all my stuff, and they said, go to the helicopter pad, and there's a helicopter going to go north. And so he told me to get on that helicopter. I said, okay. So I did, and landed at LV English in Central Highlands, 2 Corps. And from there, processed in, and the first sergeant said, go get some equipment, meal, ammo, rucksack, and all that stuff. And he said, there's a helicopter that's going to go to a little site north of English. And so I got all my equipment, got on a helicopter, and flew out there, and landed on a little bitty small hill, little CP camp. And it was the, I was assigned to the 173rd Bravo Company, 2nd Bat. 3rd Platoon was out there. So from there, that's where I started my career in Vietnam.
Now, Frank, your combat experience, has it had any lasting effects on your life?
Yeah, it. You have reminders out here, even in the USA. Of course, the sound of the helicopter, which everybody talks about, and then the loud noises, and even the jet smell. You smell that, and the clouds. Even the clouds in the air will put me, back in Vietnam for a short period. I know it may be just for a couple of seconds, but I'm there, and. But yeah, those are reminders out there. They're still there, and it'll shoot you back, mm-hmm. and kind of wake up and say, "Oh, I'm here."
Well, Vietnam—that was the war that really made the public understand what PTSD was. At the time, did you have any knowledge of what that was, or was there any type of treatment or any type of counseling available for you when you came home?
No, when I left Vietnam, there was no mention of PTSD. Then I went from Vietnam to Germany for about 15 days home, and I went to Germany. But there was still nothing mentioned about PTSD. I didn't know anything about PTSD until I went to work down Lake Texoma as a park ranger. And this veteran came up to me, saw he had a hat on. He said, I asked him, is you a Vietnam vet? I said, yeah. He said, you getting any compensation? I said, what? Compensation for what? He said, PTSD. I said, no. He asked me what I did in Vietnam, and I told him. He said, you need to go sign up. So apparently he knew the signs and all that stuff. And to me, I didn't know anything. I thought I was okay. Nothing wrong with me. Everybody else is messed up. But yeah, that's how I got involved with PTS, and I did go to programs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But that was how I got notified about PTSD.
All right. But, Frank Sewell. Frank, appreciate it so much coming on the show and sharing your story with our listeners as well. Frank Sewell, a Seminole veteran from Oklahoma. I want to bring Rachelle Pablo into our conversation now. She's in Washington, D.C. She's a museum specialist for the National Native American Veterans Memorial at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. She is Dene. And Rachelle, let's talk about your connection here. You studied art at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, and you've got that focus. What's the relationship between art and the Vietnam War that you've observed?
There's a lot of influence from the artist's lived experiences. I myself am an Army veteran, and it's an honor to be in this role to serve our Native veterans throughout Turtle Island, the Native Hawaiians, and the Alaska Natives. And the connection, I wanted to focus on T.C. Cannon, Tommy Wayne Cannon, who's Kiowa and Caddo. So he is one of the legends of Indigenous Institute of American Indian Art. He's a Vietnam veteran, but it's reflected and echoed in his work. And I also want to acknowledge for sure this memorial, the National Native American Veterans Memorial. It was created, conceptualized, and designed by Mr. Harvey Pratt, who's here on your panel. And so it reveals itself in so many ways and in expressions. You know, it can be embodied like the metaphor in Mr. Cannon's paintings and his atomic bomb he uses as metaphor, and just kind of the destruction of that. But I argue that he was also influenced by the location being in Santa Fe, as he also attended Institute of American Indian Arts from 1964 to 66. And so it kind of all is comes together in very interesting ways. And so this reflection of art, you know, the Veterans Memorial, the National Native American Veterans Memorial here, it, you know, I don't want to overspeak because Mr. Harvey Pratt's here. And I think it pulls the emotion of viewers. And it also, there's this visual dialogue that occurs, whether it's visual, like the memorial is sensorial in various aspects, not just to look, you know, not just looking, but you immerse yourself into the space. You hear the water. You hear there's songs that are around the memorial. There's also, you see these, you know, the water, and it embodies all the elements because Mr. Pratt is so brilliant in integrating all of these factors into this space. And, you know, T.C. Cannon, also known as Tommy Wayne Cannon, there was a very, very amazing exhibition from Karen Kramer, from the curator of contemporary Native art from the Peabody Essex Museum, and it was called T.C. Cannon at the Edge of America. And there's a huge influence in his work. And he passed young. You know, he was a paratrooper in the 101st Airborne Division. So I think this is how it reveals itself. I'm personally invested not only as an artist and an art historian, but also a veteran, and being able to be in the position and to be right and center and to walk into around and do my walkthroughs with the memorial, I couldn't be anywhere else. I mean, that space is of a healing, and there's prayers that are offered, you know?
Sure.
Okay.
Rochelle, we've got a couple of minutes before we need to wrap up the show, but I wanted to also ask you, you have family members, elders in your family who were in the Vietnam War. Can you talk about those folks?
Yes, they are now ancestors. I have two uncles, one on my paternal side and one on my maternal side. Peterson Tallman was a Vietnam veteran, and he is my mother's brother. And also my uncle, my dad's brother, is Ray Shack. And these two were amazing men. And unfortunately, Ray passed from the results of being exposed to Agent Orange. And so it's powerful. And that's my response. And but I do want to just mention on May 26th, on Memorial Day, we're having an event called Service and Sacrifice, and Mr. Alan Ho will be one of our main speakers. And yes.
All right. All right, Rachelle, really appreciate your input with our conversation as well. Rachelle Pablo, she's there in Washington, D.C. with NMAI's National Native American Veterans Memorial, and she's also a veteran as well. And with that, unfortunately, we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up this show talking about 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War. Want to thank all of our guests who joined the conversation today. We had Harvey Pratt, Francis Whitebird, Frank Sewell, Rachelle Pablo, and Alan Ho, who joined us as well. So appreciate them spending time with us here today on Native America Calling. And please join us again tomorrow. Until then, I'm Sean Spruce. You've been listening to the one, the only Native America Calling. Have a great rest of your day.
DT-TRAC, your healthcare partner across Indian Country, supports this show. DT-TRAC provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-trak.com. Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Service.